This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. When Jesus was being crucified, the Bible says that his mother, Mary, stood by his side at the cross. He was in his hour of greatest pain and suffering, and she chose to be there, to show that she cared. Pope Francis cited that biblical example yesterday in his letter to the worldwide Catholic community, reacting to the latest revelations of sexual abuse within its ranks. A grand jury recently released a report documenting more than 1,000 abuse cases in Pennsylvania. Mary was right. When someone is in pain, you stand by them. You let them know that you're there. So why has the Catholic Church failed to stand fully with sexual abuse victims in their pain? And is it too late for the church to change? We'll explore that question with a practicing priest and a former priest who also suffered abuse. After this.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
Hey, this is Stretch Armstrong.
And this is Bobbito Garcia, the hosts of What's Good.
We're kicking off a new season with legendary singer-songwriter Erykah Badu.
That's why they call me Fat Belly Bella, because they never know when I'm going to be impregnated.
Subscribe now.
Joining us from WESA Public Radio in Pittsburgh is its reporter, Virginia Alvino Young. She covers race, identity, and equity and has been covering the scandal in the Catholic churches there. Virginia, welcome to 1A.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is attorney Mitchell Garabedian, known for representing abuse victims in Boston during the Catholic Church scandal of the early 2000s. Stanley Tucci played him in the Oscar-winning movie Spotlight. Mitchell, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I should note we reached out to a number of representatives from the Catholic Church, including Washington, D.C.'s Archbishop Cardinal Donald Wuerl, Chicago's Archbishop Cardinal Blaise Supich, Bishop Timothy L. Doherty, who's the chair of the Committee for the Protection of Children and Young People for the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. They all declined to participate. Cardinal Daniel N. DiNardo, the president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, also declined, and Pennsylvania's Attorney General Shapiro declined as well. We would still love to speak with them, and all those offers to talk still stand. Virginia, let me start with you and the report that came out last week regarding the Catholic Church dioceses in Pennsylvania. There's so much in this report that is kind of gobsmacking. Was there one particular aspect of the report that people seemed to latch on to the most strongly that seemed to be the most damning?
Yes and no. In a lot of ways, it's a lot of what we've heard before in other places in the country, right? I mean, these really atrocious things happening, really unheard of things that go beyond child rape in the sense of the scope of the abuse. And I think here in Pittsburgh, something that really stuck with people was this idea of collaboration within the priests who are really working together to target, abuse, share intelligence, share victims within one another. There was a system of not just grooming, but then identifying the boys who had been groomed for abuse to make them easier targets for other priests, something like giving them a gold necklace so that other priests would be able to see exactly which of the boys would be the most vulnerable and had already been basically placed into that system. So it's sort of that collaboration, the next level of abuse that goes beyond all of these individual actors.
Wait, Virginia, I'm sorry. Hold on just one second.
Yeah.
You're saying that one abusive priest would basically mark his victim,
yes,
as a target that had already been exploited so other abusers could point him out more easily?
Yes, there was a system of sharing intelligence. And as we heard from the Attorney General Josh Shapiro at the top of the show, there was basically a child pornography ring. They were sharing these resources, sharing their efforts. So it was so explicitly known what was happening within the ranks of priests that this was the way that they were operating.
Mitchell Garabedian, you represented, as we mentioned, sexual abuse victims in Boston. I understand there are still confidentiality matters regarding who was involved and what they went through. But broadly speaking, do you see any similarities between what we're learning about in Pennsylvania and what you dealt with in Boston?
Well, first of all, there really aren't any confidentiality agreements with regard to the Boston cases. That's what the Boston cases were all about. And the Gagin cases, that my clients just would not sign confidentiality agreements, even though the church was throwing millions of dollars at them. But the similarities, it's the same blueprint. You have sexual abuse of innocent children by a respected religious figure. You have this common thread of secrecy. When the child was sexually abused, the priest would tell the child, you have to keep this a secret, because if you don't, you're going to be burned in hell, or your parents are going to get divorced, or something horrible is going to happen to your family, and the child believed that. When the parent, on occasion, reported the abuse to the parish priest or the bishop or the diocese or the archdiocese, the parent would be told, we'll look into this, but you have to keep this quiet for the sake of the reputation of the church, which is first and foremost. And canon law states when sexual abuse matters are looked into, they shall be kept secret. So you have the wholesale sexual abuse of children with a common thread of secrecy, with criminal acts by criminal priests sexually molesting children, and criminal acts by criminal supervisors sexually abusing, allowing the sexual abuse of children. And you have it going all the way up the ranks. This is just the tip of the iceberg. The Attorney General Shapiro has done a fantastic job so that victims can try to heal. But this is just the tip of the iceberg.
I want to introduce two more voices to the conversation. But before we do that, Virginia, briefly, if I could just ask you whether any more victims have stepped forward since the report was released last week. Have there been any more developments there?
Absolutely. Just like the last grand jury report that came out in the other two Pennsylvania dioceses, you know, the Attorney General office opens up a hotline for people to come forward with that story, with their stories. That hotline got swamped a couple years ago, and the hotline since last week has been swamped since now. And when you talk to the SNAP organization, the survivors of those abused by priests, they're saying they're hearing from folks not only just throughout the state, but around the world. You know, some in their 80s are coming forward with their own stories just now. So it definitely inspires a lot more people to come forward. So even though 1,000 victims are named in the report, the Attorney General's office estimates that number to be in the thousands.
Joining us now from WBEZ in Chicago is Father Ryan Adorjan, a priest of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Joliet. He is the parochial vicar at the Cathedral of St. Raymond Nonatus and Sacred Heart Parish. Father Ryan, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is Bob Hotson, a former Catholic priest. He is co-founder and president of Road to Recovery, a nonprofit that assists survivors of sexual abuse. Bob, welcome.
Hello, good to be with you.
Father Ryan, let me start with you. You were ordained this year. Congratulations on your ordination.
And
you were quite young when the Boston sex abuse scandal kind of entered the public consciousness. I only can wonder what impact that had on your decision to remain in the church, and not only that, but to become a priest.
That's right. I was only 10 when the news from Boston broke. And so I kind of came of age in the church in a time when the sexual abuse was just sort of known. It was a fact, a sad fact of life in the church at that time. And I never had a priest in my parish who gave me any reason to fear him or to be afraid of him. The priests that I knew were good and holy men, and those were the ones who inspired me. And certainly as I went through seminary, you know, kind of getting more familiar with the scandal in my own local church and seeing and knowing some of the other priests who may have been accused or who had allegations substantiated against them, I knew that that wasn't my church, that that wasn't what I wanted to be about, and that as a young priest, I knew that the church was about something much greater than that and much deeper than that, and it was about bringing Jesus to people.
Bob, you are a former Catholic priest. What was it that led you to leave the church? Was it this scandal or was it something else?
Oh, no, it was this scandal. I lost two careers because of this scandal. I was an Irish Christian brother for 23 years, and I was sexually abused beginning the day I stepped into the religious life when I was told by my first superior that I was a cold person and I needed to be warmed up and he was going to be the one to do it. And then I was abused by
my novice. You needed to be warmed up?
Right.
Oh, God.
That's correct. That was my introduction to the religious life, and I spent 23 years attempting to survive in that with various stages of depression and anxiety and all kinds of ailments. After I was sexually abused by the second person, my novice master, I told the third superior, and he told me, oh, yes, Bob, you were preyed upon, and it's not your fault. But that night, as he slept in my parents' house discussing this with him, he crawled into bed with me and started to abuse me in exactly the same way that the first two abused me. So, you know, this is, and then when I went to the seminary at the age of 42, I was propositioned for sex by a man who was 15 years younger than I was. He told me that if I were to be his friend, I'd have to be his bitch. When I reported him to the bishop, nothing was done.
Why did you stay in the Catholic Church?
Well, this is my lifelong desire was to serve people. I had the right attitude, and I had the right direction. But what I entered was a kind of a den of iniquity.
One of our listeners sent us this through the 1A Text Club. I am a Catholic in Pennsylvania, and my faith in organized religion has been shaken. I have connections to four of the priests listed for my diocese, four priests listed in this report. One married my parents in the 50s. Another married my sister in the 80s. A third baptized my two youngest sons in the 90s. And the last was my pastor in the last 5 years. My former bishop paid off one victim with $3 million and sympathized with a priest who impregnated a teenager, not with the teenager. You bet I'm upset. Father Ryan, what has the reaction been like among your congregants, and how have you ministered to them about all this?
Certainly, it's not been as strong as it has been on the East Coast and in Pennsylvania, especially because obviously those are people, as that text message said, that they knew those people, they knew those priests. And if and when a grand jury report comes out in Illinois, certainly our people will know those priests, that those have been priests with great connections to their lives. And so, gosh, it's understandably terrible. And the reaction largely from my people, both at the cathedral, which is a large, more Anglo community, and Sacred Heart Parish is a very small but African-American community, and both parishes have been affected by abuse in the past. The reactions have been very similarly strong, a kind of, you could feel the spirit of enough is enough already. And so I just talked about it very openly this weekend in my homily and after Mass was over. And I just tried to explain to people what I could explain. I mean, I'm a 26-year-old, very young priest who still chose to become a priest in the midst of this and who did not experience anything even remotely close to what the other gentleman was talking about. And gosh, I hearing his story makes me cry out. I could not imagine being in the seminary with that kind of situation. So what I did this weekend is I just simply said, all I can do is tell you what the church has done to make it more difficult, to make it more arduous for a man to become a priest. And so I just explained to them the very detailed and intricate process that a lot of dioceses and seminaries have now for screening candidates before they even get into the seminary, and then what happens in the seminary for those 7 or 8 years of formation to ensure that we're ordaining a man who is healthy, a man who is capable of sexual integration, a man who is capable of proper relationships with other people of all ages. Because as we've heard from so many of these people in text messages and on Twitter, that, you know, their faith in Catholicism, the truth of it has not been shaken, actually. Mm-hmm. But the faith in men, rightly so, has been shaken, that what those men did was horrible. It was disgusting and wrong. And we have to stand up as a church and be confident to say that it's deplorable on every single level.
Leon emailed, I was raised in the Roman Catholic Church. I am now an atheist who believes that the 501c3 status, the tax-exempt status, of Catholic churches in this country should be revoked. Any other nonprofit that engages in such depravity would have been shut down. Mitchell, let me bring you back in for a second. Is there something, and Bob, I'd like you to answer this too, is there something that you see from your perspective, Mitchell, that's specific to how the church operates that you believe fomented the culture where these kind of abuses could occur? These abuses do happen in Protestant churches too that are more decentralized. Is there something specific about the Catholic Church from your view that allows this to take root?
The Catholic Church has this attitude of we want complete devotion to the church. There's a phrase used, cradle Catholics. And many families are cradle Catholics, and that's the ultimate in religious faith with regard to Catholicism. You put the church before you, before your family. If you have 50 cents and you need to buy something, if the Catholic Church needs that 50 cents before, you give that 50 cents to the Catholic Church before you give it to yourself, even if it's for food. There's this ultimate blind faith coupled with the secrecy, which I mentioned earlier, coupled with the Catholic Church, the priest is our representative of God on earth. He is God's voice on earth. So many times I've heard, hundreds of times, I've heard from victims, and I've represented thousands of victims who have said, I thought God was mad at me because I didn't like that sexual abuse. I didn't feel good about it. And I've carried that guilt with me, that Catholic guilt with me, my whole life.
Bob, from your perspective, is there something about the culture of the Catholic Church that allows these abuses to take place?
Well, yes. What has happened is power has become abused in the Catholic Church. And sexual abuse is one of the symptoms of that. Financial abuse is another symptom. Spiritual abuse, theological abuse. This medieval notion, like the divine right of kings. You know, we have a pope, and he gives power to whomever he wants. And they're called cardinals and archbishops and bishops. Even priests. I never had any power as a priest. The bishop had total and unequivocal control over me, essentially. So we have this group of people who run this organization who now believe that they have the divine right to do the things that they do. We call them princes of the church, unfortunately, in the Catholic Church. So until that notion of divine right, of we can do whatever we want to whomever we want, whenever we want, that unless that is completely destroyed, the church will never change, and the same policies and practices that caused this crisis of sexual abuse will continue.
I know we have to pause in a moment, but Virginia, do you get the sense that Catholics in Pennsylvania are rethinking the way they engage, demanding changes or asking more questions about the way things work?
It's an interesting time for specifically the Pittsburgh Diocese, which is actually undergoing a large organizational redesign. They're consolidating like almost 180 parishes into like 50 parishes. And so there's a lot sort of up in the air right now. And a lot of kind of the most, you know, faithful, you know, attendance is in decline, contributions are in decline, profitability, you know, everything is sort of up in the air right now. And so it's hard to say sort of what the future will hold for this specific segment of the faith here in southwestern Pennsylvania. But, you know, we do hear survivors urging Catholics to sort of ask more questions, talk to, you know, this is really out there. This is explicitly on the table now. You're in a perfect position to be questioning the leadership. How transparent that leadership will be? Well, we have some people who have been dissatisfied with that so far.
One of the big questions being asked comes from Jen, who wrote on our Facebook page, what could the Catholic Church have possibly done instead of what they did do? If a priest confessed his sins in good faith and was given absolution, wouldn't the church have to keep him? What could they have done differently? Good question, Jen. Now that this grand jury report has come out, what would justice look like and what might change look like? Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting your shortlist of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Sam Sanders here. On my show, we talk to stars on the rise. Jimmy O. Yang from Crazy Rich Asians and Silicon Valley. Brian Tyree Henry from Atlanta. Darcy Carden from The Good Place and HBO's Barry. All in your feed now. Join us on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Back now to our conversation with Virginia Alvino Young, Mitchell Garabedian, Father Ryan Adorjan, and Bob Hotson. David emailed, I am the youth leader at a parish in Delaware, and in the wake of this report, I intend to leave my position. I can't in good faith tell parents their children are safe, because now I don't trust our priests and bishop. I still call myself Catholic. Father Ryan, that reflects a number of concerns we heard from people about raising children with the church. Elizabeth left us this message.
I am a Catholic woman who is having to discuss with my partner for the first time, and my partner is not Catholic, the idea of children, and if we want any, and if so, how will we raise them, and if we will raise them Catholic. And I want to raise them into the church that I've grown up loving and still love. However, it's starting to seem like the only way to really raise my children and keep them safe might be to not introduce them to my church at all.
Elizabeth, thanks for calling in and sharing your thoughts. Father Ryan, I wonder what you tell parents who are afraid, not to put too sharp a point on it, but afraid that the priest entrusted to their child's care will rape them, will molest them. What do you say to these parents about what safety measures are in place?
Thanks. What was being said earlier about the culture in the church, I'm not sure is a fair assessment given the number of people commenting here that are no longer involved with the church as practicing people. I just get nervous because it's not, I definitely cannot speak to the way the church was because I wasn't around longer than 26 years ago. But I will say that that generation of bishops is on their way out. I think we saw that with the Cardinal McCarrick situation, I can recall a time that I was in the car with my own bishop as he was visiting the seminary, and he said to me, do you know how rare it is that this is happening right now, that you are driving your bishop to the airport? He said, when I was a seminarian 40 years ago, I was lucky to be in the same room as my bishop, to be looked at or spoken to by my bishop, and now I'm trusting you, a college kid, with my life in your car. And the whole church culture is changing that way. I've not heard a person under the age of 35 describe themselves as a cradle Catholic except as a joke. That I'm not Catholic because my mom is Catholic, but I'm Catholic because I want to be Catholic.
Well, but wait a minute. We're not talking about, you know, priests being able to drive their bishops around. I hear you on that in terms of the glacial pace with which certain things in the Catholic Church change. We're talking about parents being able to trust that the priest won't rape their son, daughter. What is taking so long to make that move?
I'm sure the move has already been made, and so we need people in the church to follow what was set forth by the church in 2002 and what's been revised several times since then in the Dallas Charter, to follow what is being proposed in the Dallas Charter. For me to become a priest, I filled out a 26-page paper application, sat through 3.5-hour interviews, a 7.5-hour psychological exam, and then for 7 years, every month, met with a priest one-on-one who wrote a report about me. The report was sent to the rector of the seminary, to my bishop, who would then come to the seminary and meet with me and talk about it. I was voted on by the seminary faculty, voted on by my seminary classmates, and in fact, with the diocese reviewed, my whole case was reviewed by a lay formation board, which is not the case. In the past, my understanding is that in some places you could call the bishop or the vocation director and say, I'd like to be a priest. And they'd say, great, nice to meet you. Go to this seminary at this time. And that was that. Anybody was getting into the priesthood, which is not the case now. And as I said, I can't speak to what it's like on a national level, but I can speak to this, that people know their priests today, and people have to make that judgment for themselves, that I can't promise you that one priest will do one thing, but I can promise, and I know that there are several individual priests in my diocese that I've spoken to who have promised that this is what they're about. And I wish I could speak for everybody, but clearly, as we see from this scandal, I can't make a mass judgment,
right?
Because all the data shows that the vast, vast, vast majority of Catholic priests in this country remain celibate, remain faithful to their vocations, and remain good stewards of the Lord's vineyard.
Now, I will grant you, Father Ryan, that a number of our listeners have said that they have very healthy, very fulfilling relationships with the Catholic Church, including Michelle. Michelle emailed, I was raised Catholic and continue to practice and have sent my kids to Catholic schools. If we had any of the experiences of abuse or seen a cover-up, I would leave in a heartbeat. However, our experience has been extremely positive. Leaving the church would mean leaving our whole parish community, our friends, our teachers, pretty much our whole social circles. These are really good people who do really good work. Before I move on to the rest of the panel, Father Ryan, suppose that you saw a priest in your diocese who you knew was doing something untoward, who you were certain was abusing children, was molesting children, was preying on them. How would you handle that?
911, what's your emergency?
You would call the police?
I would go to the bishop right away, to the vicar for priests, and I would say to them that this, if I knew absolutely for sure, I would say, yeah, you're going to handle this on the ecclesial level, but I'm going to get the ball rolling, which is what the church encourages you to do, that if you have an allegation of abuse, you go to the police first, and then you go to the church.
I want you to repeat that. You go to the police before you go to your superior in the church.
Yeah, read almost every statement from the bishops that's come out since the grand jury report that says our policy in this diocese is that if you have an allegation of abuse against a priest, contact local authorities, law enforcement, and then call the diocese victim assistance coordinator in your local diocese to get an investigation going in the church with the lay review board, while law enforcement is also doing its own thing, kind of in a parallel way.
We've been hearing from several of you who are involved in the Catholic Church, including Mike, who is a Catholic priest in Minnesota. He left us a message with steps that he believes should be taken to address this sexual abuse scandal.
Secure an empty and full public view, all secret archives in every single Catholic diocese across the world, including the Vatican. Drop the time limit for reporting sexual abuse, or at least offer a 5-year grace period for all those who have been sexually abused by Catholic priests, bishops, and cardinals, and then who have gone on and criminally covered up the abuse.
Mike, thanks for calling in with those suggestions. Mitchell Garabedi, and I wonder if those seem like good steps toward addressing these issues. It just sounds like shining a little more sunlight on the records within Catholic parishes.
Well, first of all, the transparency, which was just raised, would be healthy for victims to try to heal. Again, as I mentioned earlier, they would realize that they're not the only ones. But the Catholic Church also is an entity that has allowed the wholesale sexual abuse of children, tens of thousands of children, for decades upon decades, while pedophiles sexually abuse innocent children and supervisors turn their backs. Why does anybody think they're going to really change on a dime? It's Pope Francis did not give one example of how the Catholic Church was going to change its culture. All he did was apologize, and it was spin control. There was not one example of change. If there's been change within the Catholic Church, why isn't Pope Francis releasing all documents right now? Why is Cardinal Dolan pouring millions of dollars into New York with regard to paying lobbyists to oppose statutes of limitations changes? Why are they doing that in Pennsylvania? I represent 133 Haitian children who were sexually abused in Haiti at Project Pierre Toussaint, who were abused by a layperson who received almost a 20-year prison sentence. It was at a Catholic school, Project Pierre Toussaint. I represent them with Simmons Hanley, another law firm. These children were raped in a wholesale fashion. Most of them, after 2002, when the National Catholic Conference of Bishops instituted their new norms for the safety and protection of children. The Jesuits ran that school, Fairfield University ran that school, and the Order of Malta ran that school. And I have 50 cases in federal court in Connecticut. We've been in litigation for 5 years. Why are the lawyers for the churches fighting these cases to this day, tooth and nail?
Well, I wonder, Bob Hodson, if part of it has to do with changing some of the leadership at the top. There are more than 3,000 people, most of whom are connected to the Catholic Church, who signed a letter on the Daily Theologian calling for all U.S. bishops to resign in response to this report out of Pennsylvania. Archbishop Donald Wuerl, who is the Archbishop of Washington, D.C., used to be the bishop in Pennsylvania. He was listed in the grand jury report as a bishop who did not always appear to put survivors of abuse first. And he's rapidly becoming the kind of public face of a church that some consider out of touch with the people. Is that part of the solution? I don't know if just a wholesale off with their heads from the whole top of the Catholic Church in the U.S., but how much of this has to do with changing the top of the hierarchy wholesale?
Yes, the wholesale off with their heads has to occur. Remember, I was ordained by Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. I was ordained by a pedophile bishop, okay, in 1997. Cardinal Wuerl should be ashamed of himself and should resign immediately. The report out of the Pittsburgh diocese is nothing but outrageous. And he knew what he was doing, and he knew the cover-up that he was performing. That how the man is able to sleep at night is beyond belief, and how most of the bishops of the United States and the world are able to sleep at night. Remember when Francis convened the bishops of Chile over in Rome? He allowed them to resign instead of saying to them, gentlemen, I'm firing every one of you because Chile is in terrible, terrible shape with this crisis. The same thing should happen in America.
Virginia Alvino-Young, what kinds of steps do you see happening in Pennsylvania as it relates to addressing these issues? Is there anyone who's leading the call for change, and are the dioceses listening?
the survivors of childhood abuse are really leading the call for change. I mean, you know, you can talk about this as being in somewhat in the past, but you have to remember that so much of this is well within living memory. There are many living survivors. There are many of the predatory priests, as well as the bishops who are in charge, who, as we see with Cardinal Wuerl, who've really moved up in the ranks, who are still in power and gaining more power. So it's really hard to say, you know, well, you know, Pittsburgh's Bishop David Zubik now wasn't the bishop at the time when the majority of these allegations were happening, but he did engage in those practices. That was the leadership that he was brought up in. So when he says now we've learned from the past that we have that the church today is not the church that it was 30 years ago, well, you engaged in these practices is what the report really alleges. He was involved in the decision to really shuffle around priests from parishes to parishes, and there are multiple allegations of him having credible assault allegations and not contacting the authorities. And so he says, you know, we have these new training programs that every volunteer and staffer has to go through. The new thing that he just announced to the parishioners on Saturday was, okay, we're going to have this external sort of audit of what our policies are. But the thing is, you have a lot of victims now who are still grappling with wanting their day in court, wanting justice, right. And you still have a lobbying arm of the church that is fighting legislation that's currently in the state's state house to reform the statute of limitations. And so no one's really impressed with the words on the survivor's ends when, you know, there's not a lot of action taking place. There's words of action, but are they really challenging these laws to fight for reform? No, they're not.
Father Ryan, I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up another cultural change that a number of our listeners have suggested is way overdue for the Catholic Church. Claudia emailed, "I'm so tired of the holier-than-thou attitude of the Catholic hierarchy all the way to the Pope. Their platitudes of sorrow and apology are hollow, without meaning. Talking around the actual issues will not lead to any real reforms. Drastic change is necessary and is quite straightforward," and she lists four things. One, abolish celibacy. Two, ordain women. Three, eliminate the statute of limitations. And four, prosecute church leaders. Now, we've talked about three and four, the statute of limitations and prosecuting church leaders. But celibacy and the ordination of women constantly come up as a sign that the Catholic Church is behind the times. How do you view that, Father?
As to your comment that the church is behind the times, I mean, I think Jesus said himself in the gospel that the world will always hate you because of me. So I'm not sure that the church is meant to be in with the times. The church is not of the world. The church is in the world. It's a beacon of something that is a bigger reality than just what the world wants.
It does say that, but it also says that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. So there's a little
balance
there.
Well, right. And unfortunately, the people in the world and some of those, I mean, I think people will be shocked when I say that the church does not teach to abuse children. And maybe the people in the highest levels of the church have not been following church teaching. Somebody needs to say that to them. I totally agree with that. But the celibacy question, I mean, celibacy won't solve anything. Married men commit abuses. Here in Illinois, we have Dennis Hastert, the former U.S. Speaker of the House, is from a town next to mine, abused something like 14 young men in a high school locker room. He was married. Abuse happens every day in married homes by married men and women. And so I'm not sure that that's going to be what solves it. I mean, celibacy, as Jesus says, is truly a gift. It's people are called to celibacy for the sake of the kingdom of God. And if you don't live your celibacy, and if you don't want to be a chaste priest, then that's not a problem of the church. That is a problem of your own moral integrity.
Father Ryan Adorjan of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Joliet in Illinois and parochial vicar at the Cathedral of St. Raymond Nonatus and Sacred Heart Parish. Father Ryan, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Bob Hotson, former Catholic priest and co-founder and current president of Road to Recovery. Bob, thank you.
Thank you.
WESA reporter Virginia Alvino Young, who covers race, identity, and equity. Thanks, Virginia.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And attorney Mitchell Garabedian, known for representing victims of sexual abuse in Boston. Mitchell, thank you.
Thank you very much.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.